Two journalists get a fresh view of America by visiting small cities and towns, including Eastport, Maine. James Fallows is best known as a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and the author of 11 books, including China Airborne and Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq. But for his most recent project, he didn't go to a foreign country. He came home to the U.S. Fallows and his wife, Deborah, also a writer as well as a linguist, traveled in their small private plane to dozens of places all over the country, got to know those communities, and then wrote about them. Their book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. One of the towns they chose was Eastport. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we talk with Jim and Deb Fallows about what they learned on their journey. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Going from town to town across America via propeller plane, authors Deborah and James Fallows learned a great deal about what makes our country tick. They've written a book about their experience and their discoveries. We'll hear about what they learned as they join us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. Deborah Fallows is a linguist and writer and the author of two previous books. She has written for publications including The Atlantic, National Geographic, and The New York Times, and has worked at the Pew Research Center, Oxygen Media, and Georgetown University. James Fallows has been a national correspondent for The Atlantic for more than 35 years, reporting from China, Japan, Southeast Asia, Europe, and across the U.S. He's the author of 11 previous books, and his work has popped up in many other magazines and on public radio. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for Jim or Deb Fallows about their journey? What observations about life in America's smaller cities and towns do you share? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Jim, I'll start with you. Tell us how this book came about. You had just gotten back from living in Beijing for several years, correct?
We had. Deb, who's here with me in the studio, had been traveling in China. During the 4 years we lived there, we tried to spend as much time as we could away from the big cities, from Shanghai and Beijing, where we had split our time. And we learned so much by going on buses or ox carts or trains or whatever to the hinterland. So we thought we came back to the U.S. after doing our stint of repatriation in D.C., where we have a house, to try to apply the same approach in the U.S. So starting in 2013, we spent about half our time between then and early 2017 in a little propeller plane, a Cirrus SR-22, for those of your listeners who are in the piloting world, going around the country, places as far northeast as Eastport, Maine, and and about 25 other places across the breadth of our great land.
Deb, what were you hoping to find as you embarked on the journey? Put yourself back in 2013, if you will.
Thanks, Jennifer. Actually, we had no idea what we'd find. We intentionally were going to small and medium-sized towns, the ones that you don't necessarily see on the news every day. And if you do see it, it's for something like a tornado or, God help us, a shooting or the Iowa caucuses. So we came back with a sense that there was a lot more going on in small towns than we had probably had a chance to hear about. And so we were heading for towns that had some kind of, we would think, a narrative to tell. Something maybe had happened in that town, like they lost the factory closed, or the mill closed, or the mine closed, or there was a big demographic shift, perhaps. And we wanted to see how towns were addressing the issues that they might have and how they might be coming back or not, and what the civic engagement might be or not. So it was really quite an open book for what, so to speak, for what we were going to do. But we were looking for places that seemed like they might have a story of some sort.
And how did you choose those places? It was you crowdsourced, didn't you?
We did. So back a little more than 5 years ago, I think it was probably in March or April of 2013, I put an item on my blog at the Atlantic site saying, tell us about your town. We were looking, as Deb said, for places that weren't usually in the news and didn't have kind of 3D coverage. They'd be there mainly as backdrops for either a disaster story or political story. We wanted to just hear why people thought that their town was the representative American town, or at least a representative American town. And we got back about 1,000 essays over the next week or so. And from 49 of the 50 states, and people saying, here's why Mobile, Alabama is the American town. Here's why Chico, California is the town. Why Pocatello, Idaho, et cetera. And so we then just began a combination of quote science, unquote, that is looking for places that had different population balances, different kinds of problems, and serendipity, where as we traveled in one part of the country, we try to balance that with cities in another part of the country, and leads we heard one place led to another. So it was like much of journalism, part design, part things we didn't know until we got there. And overall, we had a coverage of the U.S. that wasn't scientific in the sense of a poll, but we thought was representative. Mm. Different kinds of racial mixes, different kind of sizes, different kinds of problems and successes.
I love that you chose Eastport, Maine as one of the places you visited and spent time. And I want to ask how you decided on Eastport.
Eastport, we loved Eastport as well. And this was kind of an accident. We had some friends who lived in Portland, and we were just asking, well, what's an interesting town in Maine we should go see? And they said, Eastport, which is, you know, so far away. It's about a 4 or 5 hour drive from Portland. So it kind of fit us perfectly. So since we could get in our small plane and fly up there in about an hour, and they had, like all the towns we went to, a little tiny airstrip. There are nearly 4,000 or 5,000 of these small airstrips around the country. So that was never an issue. The one issue on landing, I might say, was that this airstrip was underused, so nobody ever expected planes to come in there. And when we made our first initial descent for landing, out pulls a tractor. A guy was mowing around the airstrip, and he was going right down the runway. So, and he didn't hear us because he had his engine on, and so we had to circle around, kind of try to get his attention and nudge him off the landing strip before we could land.
Oh, that sounds scary. Well, I had to grin when I read that the first person you met in Eastport was Bob Peacock, because as a reporter here in Maine, I believe Bob might have been the first person I met on my first trip to Eastport. So why don't you tell me about arriving in Eastport and how you decided, what to report on in that community?
So the backstory of Eastport, for those of the listeners who might not be aware of it, is it's the last, or depending how you look on it, first city in Downeast Maine, right across the straits from Campobello Island. There was a time decades ago when it had a huge sardine canning industry there. There was a railroad there that actually ran up from New York City, where the Roosevelt family would take the railroad up to Eastport and then go across by the ferry to Campobello for all their famous and difficult times there. And so this is a place that is really far out there, and it has a very, very very, very intrepid group of people who are committed to make it come back. The so-called Women of the Commons, who are trying to refurbish all of the downtown, the French brothers and their family who are having the newspaper there and an art gallery, and of course, Captain Bob Peacock, who I always think of having that full title of Captain Bob. He grew up not in Eastport, but in far off Lubeck, like a mile and a half away. But this is the huge, one side of the divide, or the Hatfield or McCoys of that part of Maine, of Lubeck versus Eastport. He's worked and traveled all around the world as a sea captain. He's a very important person in the Maine Maritime Academy. But one of his roles in Eastport is sort of not mayor of Eastport, but sort of the person who is the spirit of Eastport. And when we were just tying down our airplane, when he drove up in his truck and welcomed us there, and we were in his care and that of, I think, a substantial proportion of the rest of the population of Eastport we went there three or four,
several
or five,
times,
five
right.
four or five times.
We're trying to get back.
Yes, we'll be back there again. And it's a great and vivid town.
Okay, so what did Eastport have in common with the other communities? A lot of them were much bigger cities, Greenville, South Carolina, Columbus. What was the tie? What was the thread that tied something as small as Eastport to these other communities you visited?
So I will start here. I think for all of them, there was a combined sense of local patriotism, by which I mean people who thought that it mattered to them that this place survive and that there be roles for the next generation of people, and that the assets it had, which were distinctive to that place, very different from Fresno, California, to Columbus, Mississippi, to Greenville, South Carolina, to Eastport, that those be put into place. So it was a sense of that these people weren't just happening to live there, but they wanted to be part of constituting it. The other thing that was in common with all of these communities was an inventive and with varying degrees of success process of figuring what could we do. That in Greenville, just to make this comparison, much bigger than Eastport, probably 20 times bigger than Eastport at least in population. 25 years ago, essentially all of their industry was textiles. Now, essentially none of their industry is textiles. So figuring out how they can make that shift. Similarly, for Eastport, 50 or 60 or 80 years ago, all of their industry was sardines. Now, none of their industry is sardines. So how they could have a combination of tidal energy and local agriculture and tourism and arts colonies and all sorts of other things be the basis for their new role and shipping, too.
And one thing I would add on to what Jim has said, Eastport, maybe it distinguishes itself from most of the other towns that we visited in that since it's such a tiny town, it was almost compulsory that nearly everyone in the town participate in this effort to make their town better. For example, we went to a production of The Glass Menagerie in the local theater, which happened to be on when we were there, and found everyone was wearing several hats. The stage manager was also the barista by day, and she was the nephrologist at the clinic, and she had just opened up a dog kennel. And the person taking tickets for the production was the editor of the newspaper. So it was really all hands on deck to move this town forward. And of course, in a town like Greenville, there are a lot more hands to turn to and specified efforts. But so it was a version of the same story that you had critical mass of people who were really actively engaged in the life of their community.
Deborah, you said at the beginning of this program that you didn't really have any idea what to expect. What surprises did you come away with?
I think the biggest surprise was that the sense of agency of citizens in residence in the towns across the country, that they weren't waiting around for something to happen to them. They weren't waiting around for the feds to come in and make things better or pour a lot of money into the town to improve their public institutions or a business to arrive at town. They were taking action themselves to in whatever they did, whatever their passion was, to make things better. And one of the interesting things we heard in just about every town, whether the size was 1,400 like Eastport or Columbus, Ohio, which has hundreds of thousands of people, they all said, our town is just about the right size. It's big enough that a lot of things are going on, and it's small enough that I can act myself and have an impact on this town. So the sense that people were being accountable, were taking the reins and moving these things forward in a kind of classic American spirit was maybe one of the most surprising things.
Mm. Jim, go ahead.
So just to extend that, I agree entirely with Deb in that sense that there was a there to the interior of America, which I mentioned just because the portrayal of a lot of places other than coastal cities, often in the mainstream media, is of people as being the objects of things that are happening to them, of economic trends and political divisions and et cetera, et cetera. And of course, there are trends that are bigger than all of us. The sardine industry was going away. Drought was affecting people. We saw in the Plain States. But most people, I guess the surprise to us is that most people did not like to think of themselves as being objects, but instead finding ways to figure out a new path for themselves, for their families, for their communities, for their businesses, and all the rest. And I think this is the meta point for American politics at the moment, is we have, I guess we are trying to convey the message of this starkly different perspective. At one level of national politics, which we don't even need to get into, there's the paralysis and polarization and dysfunction and inability to do very much. But then you have, on the other hand, in hundreds of places across the country, thousands of places, people trying new experiments about school systems and about private-public partnerships and about a dozen other things, and feeling as if they're basically moving in the right direction rather than the wrong direction, despite all their obvious problems.
So, Jim, despite the polarization we hear about constantly in the news and we see coming out of your town, Washington, you didn't feel that when you visited towns.
We felt a very, very stark contrast. I think that national politics is as divided as people think. It is the second worst division in our national history, the first, of course, being between 1861 and 1865. It is really bad at the national level. But you often hear on cable news shows, oh, the country is divided, the country is polarized, people can't talk to each other. That is true if you ask them, what about Trump? What about Mueller? What about Hillary? What about the emails? It's not true if you ask people, say in Eastport or in Greenville or other places, what's happening in this town? And I'll give you just two quick illustrations of that. One is, I know for a fact that many of the that on issues of national politics, many of the people in Eastport are at really opposite poles of the national spectrum. And I know that because it's come up in our talks with individuals of them, separately. But when they're talking about the city, the region, what can be done with their natural assets there, it just is not a factor. The other quick illustration is that we spent time both in Greenville, South Carolina, and Burlington, Vermont. And your listeners will know that on national politics, those are really opposite places. Greenville is the home of Trey Gowdy and Bob Jones University. Burlington, Vermont is obviously the home of Bernie Sanders. But if you didn't know about those opposite factors, you would think they were the same place. They work the same way. The mayor works with the companies, works with the schools, et cetera. So America is very badly divided at the national political level, but America in the other 95% of its existence still has this functional ability.
We're talking with James Fallows and Deborah Fallows. Their new book is Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. When we come back, we'll talk about the experience of reporting by flying and ask you about some of the libraries and schools you've encountered. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Maine Health Cancer Care Network. World-class cancer care right here in the place that gives strength. Home.
On the next Fresh Air, Viv Albertine, guitarist and lyricist for one of the first all-women punk bands, the British band The Slits. In her 60s now, she's been married, divorced, survived cancer, and raised her daughter. She has a new memoir, her second. Terry Gross talks with her about what the punk aesthetic and anger from her youth mean to her now. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 right here on Maine Public Radio. Looking for something to do? Want to let folks know about something your organization is sponsoring? The community calendar is your answer. It's online at mainepublic.org. It's easy to enter information about your event. You just fill in the form. It's easy to find things. You can search by type of event, date, or location, and there are hundreds of events listed. Maine Public's community calendar, bringing the people of Maine together with concerts, exhibits, workshops, lectures, and baked bean suppers, as well as quite a bit more. It's all at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, a look at America through the eyes of its small cities and towns. Joining me from WAMU in Washington, D.C., Jim Fallows and Deborah Fallows. Jim is a longtime correspondent for The Atlantic. He's authored books, written for magazines, and served as President Carter's speechwriter. And Deb Fallows is a linguist and writer who has written two previous books, and her work has also appeared in many publications. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You decided to do this journey, this 100,000-mile journey, by plane. Jim, you're a pilot. Deb, what do you gain from seeing things the way that you did?
So, yes, Jim's the pilot, and I am ground control. And so it's amazing in a number of ways. One thing that I can enjoy that Jim doesn't have the luxury to do since he's piloting is the approach to the small towns. As we fly in at very low altitude, starting at about 2,500 feet, and come in over the town, you can get a first sense of what's this town like. Do you see a lot of church spires? Do you see swimming pools that are above ground or below ground? Do you see factory parking lots, and are they full, or are they full of weeds with no cars around? You get a sense of kind of the definition of the town, and on a larger geographical scale, you see, why is this town here? Is because it's a port, or because it's a river, or because it's on a rail line, or because, as in the Midwest, these small towns developed every 10 miles or so? It's a very different approach at this low altitude from coming in off the highway or an interstate or coming in on a big airliner. You have a sense that there is somewhere you are arriving.
Mm. Is it ever scary?
Yes. It is occasionally scary.
I'm going to remove my headsets from next minute or so.
Ultimately, it's not scary for two reasons. One is that Jim is a terrific pilot, very conservative, and we have had one singular rule, which was there was never any place we had to be. So we wouldn't defy the weather, we wouldn't do anything dangerous, we would just wait it out if anything happened. And the other reason is that this parachute, this airplane, is a Cirrus SR-22. It has a parachute built into the entire fuselage of the airplane, like those little balsa wood planes you had when you were a kid, that they had a parachute from the top of it, and it could kind of settle down when your trajectory of flight didn't work too well. So if something happens to Jim, ultimately I could, if I thought I couldn't land the plane, pull the parachute and we would glide down to safety. It's not something that you do cavalierly, but it is a final backup to walking away alive from any kind of extreme danger.
I can also only imagine, Jim, the spectacular sights you get to see flying in a small plane so close to the topography.
Yes, I'm rejoining the conversation now. and I'll say that Deb is a great right seat person. She spent 1,000 hours in the airplane over the years and knows all about it, and in addition to being a great wife and person in all of the other ways. So the one of my life causes is that really everybody should want to be a pilot, because it is such an interesting and unique view of life. It was the case 100 years ago when flying was really dangerous. Nonetheless, the assumption in the literary world is that every writer, novelist, poet, artist, whatever, would want to be a pilot when this became available, because for the first time in human existence, you could see the world from 2,000 feet up or 3,000 feet up, where it really is a spectacularly beautiful view and revealing view, different from an airliner where you're too high to see anything in detail, different from a car for obvious reasons. But for example, I have a passage in the book about what you learn about Maine sociology by flying up the coast from the Portland area towards the Eastport area. You know, it's all beautiful, and you can see the settlement patterns, but the difference in the boats you see as you go along the coast, the difference in the kind of houses, the difference in the managed and unmanaged forest, the difference just in everything, and it's... I think the entire logic of the American landscape becomes more evident to you when you're flying around at a couple thousand feet up.
And there are a couple other things, too, as you're flying around that are surprising. One is that the country seems really depopulated. You can fly for a day across the northern plains and not see another plane and see very little on the ground except desert and plains. And you can we saw a surprising number of quarries. I mean, who knew how many quarries there are in the country? Because you don't generally drive by them. And also that, surprisingly, there are a lot of prisons near quarries. We know there are a lot of prisons, but you generally don't drive by those either. They're really easy to identify from the air.
Mm. You made a point of visiting the library everywhere you went. What does the library tell you about a town or city?
The libraries are amazing. And I must say, while I went into libraries as a kid all the time, I had a traditional sense of the hushed library where you might sit on a hot summer day reading a book in a corner. They have been entirely transformed. And if you want to know what's going on in a town, the first stop should be the public library. They are really the heart and soul of a community and serve that community in a number of ways that they didn't used to. When there are gaps that need to be filled, whether it's in technology, they'll have computers. In education, the librarians will help the teachers by giving them supplementary materials. In all kinds of civic life, from ESL classes, English as a Second Language, to citizenship classes, to fun stuff like yoga classes or, and in an entrepreneurial sense, there are maker spaces where you can learn how to operate a 3D printer, or how to use tools that were in your dad's basement shop. Or you can, if you're a young entrepreneur, find a space at a table to start your company, whereas you might not be able to afford an office in the town. So the kind of trifecta of education, technology, and civic life that's going on in libraries makes it so much more than a library. And of course, all the traditional things are there, the help from the librarians, the books that are available, the e-books, and so forth. But the libraries have become this a classic public institution in the town that is seeing what's necessary and helping drive that community to success.
And schools, you saw all kinds of interesting things happening in schools.
We did. And this again was another surprise. And it was there were two interesting things about the schools. One is how much the schools were in tune with the particular location of the town. In Winters, California, which was an agricultural town, they offered a lot of ag classes, everything from history of agriculture in California to how to keep a farm business afloat to how to run and maintain all the farm equipment. In other places, Greenville, South Carolina is a good example. And it's a good example of not only the location, but the partnership that goes on in public-private partnerships in a community around education. Greenville has become a very high-tech, big industry town with BMW and Michelin and GE. They want to train engineers. So they collaborated with the public school system and created a new school in a quite distressed part of town called the A.J. Wittenberg Elementary School of Engineering, where the engineers from these big companies helped develop the curriculum for the schools, and they sent volunteers into the schools, starting with these little bitty kids to teach them how to be comfortable with the language of light bulbs or physics or how things fly, and then growing up to be to have the chance to be good technological citizens as well as well-educated kids that would feed that economy.
We have a question from Jennifer on Facebook. She writes, which state didn't have an essay submitted for it? You know, I wondered the same thing when you said 49 states had people submit essays.
Yes, I was floating that out in a pregnant way just to see if anybody would pick up the bait. And so I just will neutrally report that the state from which we did not get any submissions at that first time was a state well known for hanging chads, for...
Really, with the population that large, isn't that interesting?
It was the state of Florida. So it, since then, we've received, over in the intervening years, we've heard people suggesting come to Lakeland, Florida, come to Pompano Beach, come to St. Pete, come to other places in Florida. So we will be to Florida, but in the first harvest, Florida was the unrepresented state.
Okay, we'll go to Larry, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question is, I'm from Chicago originally, and I went to school, college, whatever you want to call it, in the rural Midwest, and then I moved to Maine, and rural Midwest is known for being conservative, and Maine, where I live, is known for being somewhat conservative. I think people would suggest that I'm somewhat of a liberal trend. Yet I get along with my conservative friends quite well, so long as we avoid talking about politics. Have you any suggestion as to how people might go about talking with one another? I don't like it when people just summarily dismiss one side or the other. I think you can't possibly know what you believe if you don't know what the other people believe.
Okay, Larry, thanks for your question.
Yes, that's a really interesting question we've been reflecting on over these long years. And so to answer first from a in a what about us aspect to that, usually it's the case when people who work for national publications, as we do for The Atlantic, show up in some place in Iowa or Illinois or Central Valley, California or wherever, or even Maine, they start off by asking about national politics. Are you still with Trump? What do you think about Trump, et cetera? And our experience is once you do that, it's essentially just like turning on cable news. You hear arguments you are well familiar with. People get sort of angrier and angrier and more polarized. And so we didn't ever do that. We are always asking people, what's the story here in Eastport? What is the story? You know, Bangor is a place that we have intended to go and just haven't been there yet. Also Lewiston. And so we were asking them about the schools, about how immigrants and refugees are being integrated or not, about the business prospects. And the, I guess my either my combination part despairing, part hopeful answer is that I find it generally not worth talking about national politics with anybody at the moment because it is has become almost a religious issue. And instead, I think the hope for the nation and also the point of traction for most of us is the area of local and regional efforts where generally people can agree. And they can talk about it. They can talk within reasonable bounds. They can say, yeah, I see your point, but what about this? And so people with whom I really would disagree on national politics, I've had very, very fruitful interactions on what to do about promoting community colleges or what to do about improving transport systems or what to do about the new generation of new citizens who are arriving. So I guess the answer I've come to is to talk about the local where the prospects are good.
Thanks, Larry, for your call. Our phone number, again, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're talking with Jim and Deb Fallows, who have co-written a book, Our Towns, the 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. I'm curious, because you all did this, lived in China and reported in small cities and towns in China, and now are doing the same thing with your own country, what kind of contrasts you found between China and the U.S.? I mean, you're talking about things bubbling up locally here in the U.S. That's not the case in China, is it?
It sort of is, and I'll give you the mini version of my China Land of Contrast speech. One of the things we loved about being in China is that everything you could possibly say about China was true simultaneously at some point of the country. You know, it was modern and it was backward and it was tender and it was cruel and it was locally based and it was centrally organized. So I think something that we came to appreciate over the years of living in China is that for all of the obvious, enormous contrasts of economic level where China is still on average quite poor, and the political differences that are obvious, and all the other things which are the ethnic differences which are obviously there too. There is something in common between the average Chinese person and the average American person, in that in both cultures there's a real "don't tread on me, I want to do it my way" instinct. You know, surprising if you haven't spent time in China, but if you think of Chinatowns in the Western world, you can see this very entrepreneurial, free-flowing thing that is going on. So I think that we thought it was actually quite good for U.S.-Chinese interactions, which are strained in many ways, and the U.S. has serious challenges from China, the country, that most Americans who spend time in China actually end up liking it and feeling that there is some simpatico underneath with Chinese people for all the differences. And Deb wrote a great book to this effect called Dreaming in Chinese, about what you learn about China by learning Chinese language.
I think to take this to a smaller scale, one of the obvious big differences is when we were going out to, quote, small towns in China, they would likely be 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 million people. That would be a small town. It took us an airplane ride, a 2-hour drive, horseback, and then on foot to get to a real village. And that, of course, was far different from any small towns that we ever saw in America. Their dirt floors, talk about Wi-Fi access or not. No, there were not. There was just, well, actually, in that one small town, there was.
Deb's talking about a place called Yellow Sheep, a river village in Gansu province, which is sort of like the Montana of China. It's really remote.
Right. But the sense of remoteness is that it's so much more remote than in the U.S. and so much more disconnected with mainstream media. There was internet in the town for the kids at the school, but it was a closed internet. It wasn't like you could go roaming around on Google and find things. But I agree with Jim. There was more this kind of kinship of humanity than there was differences that we happen to be Chinese or American.
Well, we do have to take a quick break, but first a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to talk with an author again. Tomorrow it's author John Meacham about his new book, The Soul of America. If you have questions, you can email them or post them on Facebook ahead of time. In the meantime, if you'd like to ask a question of Jim and Deborah Fallows about their 100,000-mile journey around America's small cities and towns, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com. Coming up in just a little bit at 2 o'clock, we'll have World Affairs. The topics today, there are two. One is U.S.-North Korea relations, and the second is the need for assistance for Syrian refugees. That's coming up today at 2 o'clock on World Affairs, right here on Maine Public Radio. Do you have a special hidden corner of Maine? Are you willing to share a picture of that spot? Send us a picture of your hidden corner and a few words describing what it means to you. We'll put your photo in a virtual picture frame and share it with Maine Public's audience. All entries will be entered to win a day on the coast with Maine Coast Heritage Trust, a statewide land conservation organization. Celebrate the importance of Maine's natural wonders with us. Go to mainepublic.org and click on Events for all the details.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, learning from our smaller cities and towns. Joining me, Deb and Jim Fallows. They are the author of the book, Small Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I'll go to George, who's calling from Blue Hill. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. And I think the commentary by Mr. and Mrs. Fallows is very much on point, because I used to travel all around the country for my work as an architect. And so I was very, very sensitive to what were the economic conditions or the sense of vitality in different towns. And I really think it is something where you have to find that at the local level with basically the citizenry, the civic leaders, the local government, the all the various organizations that have care about the well-being of a locality. And so in Blue Hill, where I'm calling from, there is a lot of that, you know, civic sense of, you know, like trails, you know, lots of walking trails, trying to revitalize areas in the downtown. It's a very, very small town, much smaller than Eastport. And whereas the other part of the year, I live in Lynchburg, Virginia, which is a much bigger city, about 75,000, maybe a quarter million metro. And there, the downtown has been abandoned for many, many years, since the 50s and 60s, and now it's jumping, really. There's a lot of it. And it's from the local community, the civic leaders, and citizens thinking, well, we got to do something better than just let all these beautiful late 19th century, early 20th century buildings rot.
Sure, George, and thank you for your call. And Jim and Deb, this is something that you have sort of used as one of your measuring sticks, isn't it? What's going on in the downtown?
Yes, and I think George's point is exactly right, that the U.S. still has a surprisingly large stock of this beautiful classic Main Street architecture from the post-Civil War era through, say, before World War II. Some of it, of course, has been bulldozed, including, sadly, in my own hometown of Redlands, California. Some of it is now covered with aluminum siding, but a lot of it is still there. And just to a really surprising degree across the country, we saw this downtown revival, the buildings being rehabbed, people moving back there, especially both younger people, the so-called millennials who are wanting to have a walkable lifestyle, and the people of our dreaded baby boomer generation of feeling they want to have also a downtown existence. So we saw this in Mississippi and in South Carolina and in Oregon and in Central Valley, California, and in Minnesota and in Pennsylvania and just all over the place. So George's mention of trails also is one of Deb's favorite themes. Miss Deb.
Yes, we have to go back to George's walking trails because we finally developed this saying between Jim and me that every town had a river walk, even if it doesn't have a river. That was a sign of a successful town. Mm. And I think it's true that and it's not only a great recreational thing for the town and a kind of sign that things are moving beyond survival to a sense of well-being and recreation, but the river walks, so to speak, like the YMCAs or public swimming pools or parks and playgrounds, are really the places where people in the town can pour out and go to or go into and run into each other in ways that you wouldn't normally do in your everyday life. Besides going to the libraries, I tried to swim in the YMCA in every town that we went to that had one. And inevitably, I would meet people and see people I would not otherwise have the chance to meet as we went around, say, from schools to the civic centers or the arts centers, you know, more official places in town. It was a chance for not only me, but for people in the town to rub shoulders, literally, with each other.
Deb, I have to ask, did you swim in the ocean in Eastport?
You know, I looked and looked for a place to go into the ocean at Eastport, and I couldn't find it. But I did swim in the ocean down near Portland, and it was mighty cold.
We have a tweet from Steve. Ask James Follows to comment on the piece he just wrote for The Atlantic. Quote, "This is the moment of truth for Republicans. The GOP can either defend the United States or serve the damaged and defective man who is now the president."
So I mentioned earlier the divide between national politics, which are at a difficult impasse, and local life in the U.S., which we argue is self-renewing and in a good period. So I thought that I mentioned earlier I'm part of the dreaded baby boomer generation, which means that within my conscious memory is seeing Lyndon Johnson on TV talking about Vietnam and Richard Nixon talking about Vietnam and Watergate and Bill Clinton talking about his misleading the country about his problems, his sexual problems and all the rest. And I've never before seen a performance where a U.S. president was citing with a foreign leader against his own government. And I think that the pressure history's eyes are on those who now control the U.S. Congress, that is to say the 51 Republican senators and I think the 236 Republican representatives, or how the Republican majority in the House, to look into this, where the intelligence establishment of the United States, its institutions of judgment have said there's an attack on our governing institutions from afar, and in a way that has no precedent in my living memory. An American president has sided with the foreign interest, or at least has appeared to do so today. So that was the theme of that national and international politics post, which is in contrast to the renewal we're saying is happening around the country.
We'll go to Will, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Will. Go ahead.
Hi, Jen. Hi, Jim and Deb. I'm the president of Main Street Bath this year.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Hey.
And I haven't been able to listen to most of the show because I've been in meetings relative to Main Street. But I want to tell you, I love your book. I bought 17 copies of it and distributed it to the entire board of Main Street.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's very relevant, and in connection with your answer to the previous fellow who tweeted or sent in by email, I think the significance of what you're pointing up here has just come out in the news as well, that the Russians have been acquiring local news outlets on a long-term basis. I don't know if you read that story, but I think there's an interesting confirmation of, not a happy one, of the importance of local action based on relationships and how really it's only relationships that can get you beyond the two-dimensional stuff you see on the screen.
So Will, I'll say that for the last couple of days, Deb and I have thought that Tom Hanks, the actor, was the greatest American because he put out a tweet about our book. But I think you may now be the greatest American for getting copies of our book for all of your Main Street members. We really appreciate that, and we really admire the work that downtown renewal people are doing around the country. On the local media front, this is a serious issue. There are places we saw where there were sort of anomalous successes of local media, including in Eastport, where the Quaddy Tides has real ongoing importance there, and in Burlington, Vermont, where the former alt-weekly 7 Days has become a viable and influential statewide publication. But generally, the pressure on media every place is especially intense on local media, and local media are especially important. So one of the things we actually want to do, Deb and I, in the next stage of our lives, is to find ways to connect people who have ideas about recapitalizing local media and making it viable again, because it does really matter, and the trends you're talking about are part of the pressures on it.
Well, thanks so much for your call. We'll move to Aaron, who's calling from Bucksport. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
Hey. So thanks for having me on. I just wanted to speak to your previous point about politics being a kind of faith in America and how it's so difficult to knock people off of their notions and beliefs because they are almost, in a word, disciples. And I think a big part of the problem is the very nature of the conversation that we're having is there isn't one. There's no discussion, there's no context, there's no history, and all there are headlines and blurbs, and that's no way to have a discussion about governing a country. And it seems to me that Republicans, by and large, have abdicated their responsibility as stewards of the country, and instead have adopted what's, in my mind, the central difference between left and right, which is man versus man, or having some sort of basic semblance or obligation.
Aaron, we're running short on time. Do you have a question for our guest?
So specifically, your last point about what we can do on a local level to have that discussion, I had a few ideas, but I was wondering what we could do to foster that kind of local and maybe national debate onto fixing real problems that we have in this country.
So this is a really important and complex issue that Aaron raises. 20-plus years ago, I did a book called Breaking the News about what was then sort of the polarization of the national media, and things have gotten a lot worse since then. The sort of place marker I'll leave for Aaron is that Deb and I have been in touch with lots of people around the country who are asking just the question you are of what we can do to magnify the effects of this still healthy local discourse, which is still based on actual facts and based on actual compromise and the possibility of changing minds, to magnify that and see if there's a way to have that positive influence bubble up rather than having the negative national influence seep down. And I'll just say this is something we'll be working on. Stay tuned, and I'll try to publicize ways in which we can think of more organizational tools.
Aaron, thanks for your call. And speaking of what you're working on, this is an ongoing project, right? This is not, your book is not the end of the story here.
So, Deb, so we have a, early in the book, we say, here are the next 50 places we hope to get to, and we'll try to get there in the next sweep, including some in Florida. And that I think that we've been, Deb and I have been so impressed by the contrast. We've so been impressed by, number one, the vitality we see in 100 places across the United States, and number two, the contrast between that and D.C.-centric, just really sort of despair-inducing politics, that what we want to actually do for the next stage of our lives is try to find organizational ways to connect people who are working in different towns and to, as I mentioned earlier, magnify this impulse. So we plan in ways to be announced soon to continue this effort. Right, Deb?
That's right. Yeah, we could go one of two ways here. We could either go visiting towns and reporting on them for the rest of our lives, all of our collective lives, or we could stop right now and try to make more sense of this and to help in ways with connecting people and having movements and so forth to help it move forward.
And we're beginning a film with HBO, a documentary based on this theme, so we'll be starting to work on that.
I was just going to mention that. Well, thank you so much for reading my mind. That was Jim Fallows and Deb Fallows. They joined us from WAMU Studios in Washington. Thank you so much for being here. Their book is Our Towns, the 100,000 Mile Journey into the Heart of America.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we have author John Meacham. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.